First thing I wanted to say is a couple of people in the class asked me to put a copy of the course pack on two-hour reserve over in the Powell Library, so I did that day before. It's okay, just part of the service. so it should be there now. I didn't put the books on reserve because I think it's important for you to actually buy those books. It's not the sort of thing that you want to just pop over to the library and read quickly. Okay, today I'm going to be talking about the July crisis of 1914. And this is not going to be a blow-by-blow discussion of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand was assassinated on June 28, 1914, and then this happened, and then that happened, and then that happened. Instead, it's going to be much more analytical because we're going to be concerned with a very important problem in the interpretation of international politics. We have this, you know, general concern that defines the field, which is what makes for war? How is there anything of a general nature that you could say about why wars break out? Are there any insights we can get by grappling with that question which will give us a handle on fundamental problems of policy? Okay. And we're going to get at these problems not directly by simply, you know, developing an argument about these, but indirectly by looking at what other people, by what scholars and policymakers and, you know, pundits and so on, what people have had to say about that general issue, and analyzing those arguments in terms both of the evidence and of their internal logic. Right? So that's our concern, and we're concerned with a specific argument. Last time I was talking about how the general problem of the origins of the First World War is interpreted. I was telling you about how, there is this notion that no one was really responsible for it. It just kind of happened as a result of these, you know, impersonal forces that no one could really control. No one knew how to stop the war from breaking out. Right? And there's one argument in particular that had very great sway. I don't know if you've been exposed to it in your other classes or in high school or whatever, but this is the argument that it's the military system that was in place at the time. The system that placed great emphasis on offensive military action, on moving fast, moving hard, on a military system that was based on these war plans, these rigid war plans that you couldn't change, even if they no longer made sense in a particular political context. People were just locked into these things. And as a result of these military factors, you had a war that no one really wanted. It was not a product of political decision. It was a product of these forces that no one could control, forces of a military nature. And this, as I was saying last time, was a very important argument, both in the interwar period and in the Cold War period. The basic problem, one of the great problems in the Cold War period, is to try and understand how you could have a war, meaning a general war, a general thermonuclear war, when it was obvious that no one wanted that. The United States didn't want it. The Soviet Union obviously didn't want it. It would just result in everyone's destruction. But so if that's the case, why was this something that people were worried about? Right? The answer is you could have a war even though no one wants it. You could have a war because of the nature of the military system you have. It happened once before. It may sound a little crazy, but it happened once before, July 1914. If it happened then, it could happen again, right? And so we have to, if we want to prevent a war, the crucial thing is not reaching a political accommodation between the major powers. The crucial thing was making sure that the nature of the military system that was in place did not allow this kind of thing to happen, the kind of thing that supposedly happened in July 1914. You know, a war brought on by the workings of the military system that were in place at the time. And this is a very important argument. It was the conceptual basis, for example, of arms control. Why did people place so much emphasis on arms control during the Cold War? The answer was that through arms control, through mutual agreement, you could set up a much more stable military system, a system that was not prone to the kind of problem that could bring on a war as the War of 1914, again, supposedly had brought on. Where do you find this argument laid out? Look at the strategic literature, the most important works dealing with nuclear strategy in the United States. Thomas Shelley. How many of you have heard of Thomas Shelley? Just a handful. Thomas Shelley is the premier thinker of the nuclear age, the deepest thinker about how military power works in the nuclear age, about nuclear issues in general. He wrote a book, a collection of essays, really, in 1960 came out, called The Strategy of Conflict. And then about 6 years later, he published another book. It was originally a collection of lectures that he gave at Yale called Arms and Influence. You should read this stuff if you're interested in these questions when you get a chance. Because, you know, Shelley wasn't a historian. He was an economist. And he was concerned with the bargaining process works in international politics. And one of his key arguments had to do with the way risk is manipulated. You know, when two countries are involved in a rivalry or some sort of confrontation, each of them wants to get its way. Each of them hopes that the other side will back down. And to do that, they have to take steps that increase the level of risk that the two sides jointly will be running in the hope that the other side won't be able to bear that and the other side will back down. The risk, meaning the risk that a war could break out, a risk that a war that neither side really wants can break out nonetheless. Right? So what generates risk, according to Shelley? If international politics, time of crisis, is essentially the manipulation of risk, you have to be concerned with what causes, what generates that risk in the first place. And Shelley had an answer for this. And the answer was, maybe no one will want a war, but worse than having a war was having the other side go first in a war. If the other side was allowed to go first and you only went second, then the results would be worse than if you were the one who went first and the other side went second. It's called, you know, there's an incentive to go first, incentive to preempt. And in a world where there's an incentive to preempt, well, you can have a war even though no one really wants it. This is this famous argument. Shelley had this phrase, the reciprocal fear of surprise attack. He also has another phrase to capture this concept. The dynamics of mutual alarm. I call it the logic of preemption, but it's all the same thing. And Schelling laid this out in this really just brilliant passage in The Strategy of Conflict. You know, I'll read it to you so you can kind of get a feel for the nature of this line of argument, because it was very, very important. Schelling writes, if surprise carries an advantage, it's worthwhile to avert it by striking first. Fear that the other may be about to strike and the mistaken belief that we are about to strike gives us a motive for striking and so justifies the other's motive. But if the gains from even successful surprise are less desired than no war at all, there is no fundamental basis for an attack by either side. Nevertheless, it looks as though a modest temptation on each side to sneak in a first blow, a temptation too small by itself to motivate an attack, might become compounded through a series of interacting expectations, with additional motive for attack being produced by successive cycles of he thinks, we think, he thinks, we think, dot, 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 he thinks, we think he'll attack, so he thinks we shall, so he will, so we must. I mean, this, you know, at a purely conceptual level, this is just absolutely brilliant. This is how you can have a war, even though no one wants it. Okay. And Schelling and various other scholars who wrote in this vein, they weren't content with simply laying out this kind of logic on a purely abstract level. They wanted to show that this counts for something in the real world. And so they needed to provide some historical example where you could see this sort of logic at work. You know, this whole notion that if each side thinks that the other side is about to go first and therefore feels that, well, maybe it should go first, and each side knows that the other side is making those calculations and so on and so on, then you could have a war resulting from this incentive to preempt, even though there's no real political basis for it, right? That argument was, you know, had to be substantiated, and by showing that you could actually see it at work in the real world, and the one and only case, effectively, that they used to substantiate this, it was the coming of the First World War in July 1914. Schelling in Arms and Influence begins his chapter on the dynamics of mutual alarm by talking at some length about how this stuff came into play in July 1914. Okay. So it's an important argument. And the goal of the class today is to get at that argument, to analyze it. You know, again, applying these two tests, the test of logic and the test of evidence. When you look at July 1914, do you see that sort of mechanism at work or not? You know, and as I say, the answer to that question is profoundly important because of the role that this particular historical case plays in supporting this general argument about how a war can come, even though neither side really wants it, and how that particular argument plays a much larger role in terms of its relation to this general question of what makes for war. All right, so this business, July 1914, how war came in July 1914, and the role of the military system, it's an important issue. And you can get at it by looking at, how do you get at it? So I was about to say, by looking at the historical evidence, but not by looking at the historical evidence in this totally mindless way. You have to bring questions into focus. Bring questions into focus so that the answers turn on what the evidence shows. And the questions have to be as specific, as concrete as possible. Because the more concrete they are, the more studyable they are. Okay? So how do you go about doing that? The answer is, you look at what people who have made this argument have tried to say. What are the specific arguments that they have made to substantiate the view that the military system, the workings of the military system, explain why war came in July 1914? This is very important in methodological terms, because it's you to the extent possible you want to let these guys do your work for you, right? You let them substantiate this argument by making certain very specific and studyable claims, and then you can analyze the claims that they make in terms of the evidence, rather than just trying to go into the documents on your own and see how much this stuff counted for. And when you look at that literature, and there are all kinds of works in the political science literature, we just kind of take it for granted that the military system played an important role in the coming of war in 1914, mobilization system and so on. You look at that literature, it turns out that the arguments that people make fall into these three categories: the rigidity of war plans, the cult of the offensive, and the interacting mobilizations. So that's what we're going to look at today. The arguments that people make, do they hold up in the light of the evidence and in terms of their internal logic? The specific arguments, these three specific arguments that people make. And we can kind of begin with the whole business about the rigidity of the war plans. Okay. I'm going to put up the map now. No. Okay. It's a common argument that the plans were rigid, couldn't be changed. The rigidity of the war plans caused the war. And in fact, you had these countries in Europe, especially continental Europe, who worked out very detailed war plans. Why did you have detailed war plans? Because to gain an advantage in a war, you had to mobilize the resources of your entire society. You had to basically train as many men as possible for military service in peacetime. And you would then call up these men to their military units on the eve of a war. This is what mobilization meant. It meant calling up the reserves. And so you would have these mass armies, absolutely huge armies, millions of people, much larger than anything you have today. And to deploy a force of that sort, such a massive force, you had to work everything down very carefully in advance. You couldn't improvise something like that. You needed a particular plan for how you were going to fight the war so you could allocate the railroads and determine all the schedules of mobilization and deployment of the troops to the front and so on. And so you had these war plans. Not only that, but Germany in particular had a distinct problem. Germany is a relatively small country in terms of the resources it controls in comparison with the Entente powers. Britain is this huge empire with all these overseas possessions. France, too, has a large overseas empire. Russia is this vast country that stretches from Central Europe clear to the Pacific in Vladivostok. Right? Very large populations. How can Germany possibly stand up to a coalition like that? Couldn't afford to fight a war of attrition. But Germany did have a certain advantage. And by the way, this is very similar to Israel facing the Arab world. So you want to understand why Israel, for most of its history, had a strategy that emphasized offense, emphasized taking the initiative, and so on. If you're a small country in comparison with the size of your rivals and you can't fight a war of attrition, you need a quick decision. same logic, by the way, applies to the Soviet Union during the Cold War. Soviet Union facing a coalition of much wealthier powers, you know, United States, Western Europe, Japan, and eventually even China. You can't fight a war of attrition like that. You can't opt for a purely defensive strategy because the other side's resources will overwhelm you. So you need to go on the offense. You need to opt for an offensive strategy. It's built into the structure of the situation. Country opts for a strategy of that sort. It's not proof that it's evil or militaristic or anything like that. It's built into the structure of the situation. And the Germans had a certain advantage. They were more efficient than a country like Russia. They can mobilize much more quickly. Their railway network was much denser and so on. So Russia's going to take a long time to mobilize. You know, it's a much more backward country. And what that means is that Germany could take advantage of that fact. Germany doesn't have to defend her eastern border against Russia in the event of an outbreak of a war with the Triple Entente, with Britain, France, and Russia. She could leave her eastern border relatively undefended, concentrate all of her forces in the west, overwhelm France, you know, defeat France before Germany would have to divide her forces between east and west, or before the British could really generate a mass army that could save the day for France. And then, after France was defeated, Germany could then pivot around and face Russia. Right? So deal with her enemies piecemeal. It's a rational strategy, right? It's their only option. And to pursue that strategy, they had to move very fast. They had to, you know, work out a war plan for bringing their forces into the field and throwing those forces against France, basically as soon as the war broke out. This basic idea, this basic strategy is called the Schlieffen Plan. So the Germans had this strategy for fighting the war. People say, well, you know, these rigid war plans were cause of the war because they couldn't be adjusted to changing political realities. And in support of that argument, there's one story that's told over and over again. This is the story that on the eve of the war, the Germans received news from London that the British may stay out of the war if the Germans don't attack France, if they stay on the defensive in the west, and then just fight the war in the east. And the Kaiser receives this news, the German Emperor receives this news, and it's like, break out the champagne. This is great if Britain's going to stay out of the war. Because in a sense, Britain, in terms of her war-making potential, not forces in being, but potential, is the strongest of the Entente powers, certainly in industrial terms. If Britain could stay out, Germany would not be in a bad position at all. So the Kaiser has this meeting with his advisors to consider how to react to what was viewed as the British proposal. And the head of the German General Staff, General von Moltke, says, Your Majesty, it cannot be done. We basically have one plan and one plan only, and we can't improvise this thing at the last minute. And the claim is the Kaiser had no answer to this and gave way. Right? And this shows how the rigidity of the plans, the fact that they had only one plan, led to consequences that made no sense in political terms. All right. You apply these two tests, the test of evidence and the test of logic. First, the test of evidence. You look at the real story. Yeah, there was this meeting between the Kaiser and his advisors on the eve of the war. And it's true that Moltke said, Your Majesty, it cannot be done. We can't improvise a plan at the last minute. But the Kaiser's reaction was, we're going to do it anyway. We're not going to attack France. We're going to fight the war in the East. And Moltke was overruled. He refused to transmit the order directly to the forces in the field, so the Kaiser had his military aide transmit those orders. But Moltke said, "I was absolutely broken. I was absolutely shattered. I went home and cried tears of despair." Those are quotes from Moltke's memoirs written during the war and published after the war. Okay. He was overruled. Now, the story doesn't prove the point it's supposed to prove. Okay? That's the test of logic. Suppose the plans had been more flexible. Suppose the Germans, in this particular case, had more options for themselves, that they weren't locked into the West-only plan. Suppose they also had a well-worked-out plan for fighting the war in the East, so that they could choose to do it that way if they wanted, to fight, stay on the defensive in the West and just fight the war against Russia. Would that have prevented the war? Would the outcome have been different if they had created more options for themselves? Well, there are only two possibilities. For possibility one is that the existing plan, the plan that emphasized action in the West and staying on the defensive in the East, was militarily superior to the alternative plan. In that case, they would have done it anyway, so it wouldn't have made any difference if it was the better plan. The other alternative is the plan for staying on the defensive in the West and fighting the war in the East made more sense. That's the view that I also take. Britain would have been less likely to come in. France would not have been able to fight an effective war in the West if Germany was on the defensive. Germany had all these fortifications along the Franco-German border. France would not have gone through Belgium the way Germany did in 1914, and so on. There were all these military advantages and political advantages to pursuing the plan which emphasized the East. But if that was the case, Germany's position would have been stronger if she were able to pursue that option. If it was a superior option, that would have strengthened Germany's position during the crisis, would have meant, therefore, that in the political bargaining, Germany could have taken a harder line than she, in fact, did. And if Germany took an even harder line, why would the war have been less likely to break out? You see, you could try and think through the logic of these arguments that, well, rigidity is bad. Rigidity means you're ruling out options. If you have fewer options, doesn't that put you in a weaker position? If you're in a weaker position, don't you have to kind of pull in your horns politically? And shouldn't that make a political settlement more likely? See? That was the test of logic. Okay? The next big argument is what's called the cult of the offensive. What's the argument here? This is very important in terms of international relations theory. Any of you read the article by Robert Jervis called "Cooperation Under the Security Dilemma"? No, not a single. It's probably one of the three or four most important articles written by international relations scholars in the last 40 years or so. It was actually written right here in this building when Jervis was an assistant professor, right here at UCLA. You know what the security dilemma is? Does that term mean anything to any of you? Anyone? Basically, a security dilemma is this idea that you could have a war, even between countries that would be very happy to live with things as they were, thank you. You could have a war between essentially defense-oriented countries, security-minded countries, just want to preserve their current position. Again, this is this notion that you can have a war even though no side has a real interest in fighting one. A clash between defense-oriented countries can still be quite dangerous. Why? Because it might well be that the only way to preserve your existing position is to threaten the other guy's position. Right? That's why it's a dilemma. We don't want to upset the other guy. We don't want to threaten his position. But, well, maybe we kind of have to, simply in order to protect our own position. In a sense, the Schelling argument about preemption and so on is a specific case of this. You know, it's like, we don't want to go first and start a war, and neither does the other guy. But if the other guy is worried that we might do it, and we're worried that he might do it, and we know that he's worried about us going first, and so on and so on, maybe we really will have to do it because the alternative would be so much worse. Right? So this is the... Yeah? No. As a matter of fact, that whole Schelling argument was framed in the context of nuclear war, nuclear preemption, which was a big issue, especially in the 1950s. As we'll see later in the course, the United States strategy was preemptive. It was based on the notion that we're going to go first in the event of a war. This under Eisenhower, this was. Preemption was a big deal back in those days. Right? And so... So you have this argument that Jervis makes. You know, the security dilemma is this big problem. It could lead status quo powers to behave like aggressors. Not because they're inherently aggressive, but because that's the only way of providing for their security, is to go on the offense. Right? And then in the article, what he does is he kind of looks at the things that determine how much of a problem this in fact is, how salient is this particular problem. And one of his big arguments is that, if it's a world where the defense has the upper hand, where defense is relatively easy, then you don't really have to worry about it too much. On the other hand, if the military technology or the sort of thinking which people have places a great emphasis on offensive military action, then it's a different story. The security dilemma could be quite a serious problem. Because in an offense-dominant world, you know, countries feel that the only way of providing for their security is by attacking their rival. And their rival feels the same way. So both sides are under this pressure to go first, to attack, to, you know, and so on. Okay? And then another international relations scholar, Stephen Van Evere, took up this aspect of the Jervis argument and developed it into this, you know, quite impressive theory of war. He has a book called Causes of War. And once again, the main historical case supporting this stuff is pre-World War I Europe. And Van Evere has a couple of articles which apply these concepts to the explanation of why war came in Europe before World War I. And he makes a whole bunch of arguments there, but the most powerful of his arguments has to do with what people call windows. What is a window in international politics? It's like... Two kinds of windows, windows of opportunity, windows of vulnerability. These things have to do with changes in the balance of power, changes in the balance of military power. If we think that if war breaks out now, we're going to win, but a few years down the road, we won't have the upper hand anymore. Well, doesn't it really make sense from our point of view to have the war sooner rather than later? If it's inevitable, shouldn't we have it now? Right? That's what people call a window of opportunity. The idea is it's open now, but it's closing just like a real window opens and closes. And similarly, there's a window of vulnerability. You know, it's like, we're weak now. We're covering our strength. We'll be stronger in a few years. So while we're going through a window of vulnerability, the other side may be really aggressive and take advantage of that. And so we got to watch out for that. And so the basic argument that these people make is that all this window business is really important, and that these windows open much, much wider in periods where the offense is believed to have the upper hand than in periods where the defense is believed to have the upper hand. Defense, it doesn't matter too much. What are the problems with this whole line of argument as applied to 1914? Well, you can go into the sources, and it's not hard to show that the Germans were thinking in precisely those terms. The whole German assumption in 1914 was, if war breaks out now, they still have a pretty good chance of winning. The Schlieffen Plan is still viable. But it was precisely because the Germans had this plan. None of this stuff is secret. You can't keep this stuff secret in pre-World War I Europe. They don't even have passports in those days. The Germans are building all these railroads for non-economic reasons so that they could cart these mass armies very quickly to the frontiers in the event of war. It's all these things are discussed quite openly. So it was known, and the Entente obviously had an interest in counteracting that. This was Germany's one big advantage, her ability to mobilize quickly while Russia is still far behind, and concentrate her forces in the West. So if you want to deprive Germany of that advantage, you got to help Russia mobilize quickly by building strategic railroads of her own. And France is actually doing that, providing all kinds of funds for Russia, in large part for those purposes. Okay? So the Russians have this plan, and the plan is going to be finished by 1917. By that point, the Schlieffen Plan is no longer going to be viable because the Germans are going to have to divide their forces to deal with Russia, because Russia is going to be able to mobilize much more quickly as a result of especially the completion of the strategic railroad. So the Germans, they say, well, if war is inevitable, and it was coming to look like war was inevitable, maybe better now than later. You can find, and they say this stuff a lot. And if you take the approach that to support a line of argument, you will cite only those things that support that argument. This is called cherry picking. We'll cite all the documents that support our way of looking at things and ignore everything else. You can make a strong case, right? But there's always a problem with that cherry-picking approach. It only looks on one side. It only looks at the stuff that supports it. Because there's the problem with it is that if this is Germany's window of opportunity, and this whole notion that window is going to close pushes Germany to act in 1914, it should also have been the Entente's window of vulnerability. The Entente had every incentive to put off the war. We shouldn't fight when Germany is relatively strong. Let's delay it for a few years until we recover our strength, and Germany. Germany's chances of winning will diminish very considerably. That the Schlieffen Plan is planned for leaving the eastern border undefended at the very outset of the war, and throwing practically all your forces against the French, marching down through Belgium in the process. This will no longer be viable as a strategy. And so the question is, why do those things not cancel each other out? Germany's window of opportunity, yes, pushes the Germans forward, but the Entente's window of vulnerability should hold them back. One of those things not cancel each other out. You notice that that's simply a logic argument. It's not something that depends in any crucial way on what the evidence shows. And if they don't cancel each other out, other kinds of factors, not related to all this Windows business, should have been decisive, in which case those factors are the things that we should focus on if we want to understand the causes of the war. Okay? I mean, you can push all this stuff a whole lot further, even. It's like, what's this whole business? Offense is easy. The belief that offense is easy. Well, it can't be simultaneously easy for both sides. It's not like the armies are just going to pass by each other. Well, hi, I'm on my way to Berlin, or oh, I'm on my way to Paris. It can't simultaneously be easy for both sides, right? What this means is that in this kind of world, as opposed to a defense-dominant world, the risk of a military decision where one side has total victory and the other side has total defeat, this is going to be greater than it would otherwise be, right? And if that's the case, the two sides really have an incentive to go to war. The side that, you know, that's running the greater risk of losing should have more of an incentive to avoid the war than if it could defend itself relatively easily. You know, in a defense-dominant world, we don't have to worry about the downside risk of you know, being totally overrun, you could actually take a firmer line because the risks are so much lower. But when the risks of total defeat are so high, which is what you have in an offense-dominant world, shouldn't you, want to be more cautious? All right. So these, again, these are arguments based on the logic of the argument. And you think about all this stuff. No, the kinds of things these people emphasize, they don't provide the answer to the puzzle. The stuff doesn't explain why you had a war that could otherwise be avoided. Okay, so now we're left with the heart of the inadvertent war argument, the heart of the idea that the war came because of the workings of the military system. I'll just read you a passage from a famous book by Barbara Tuchman, who's a kind of a pop historian. Called The Guns of August, about all this stuff in 1914, played a big role during the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy said, well, we don't want what happened in 1914 to happen again in 1962. And she ends her introduction to the section of the book dealing with this stuff. She says, listen to the style it's used. War pressed against every frontier. Suddenly dismayed, governments struggled and twisted to fend it off. It was no use. Agents at frontiers were reporting every cavalry patrol as a deployment to beat the mobilization gun. General staffs, goaded by their relentless timetables, were pounding the table for the signal to move lest their opponents gain an hour's head start. Appalled upon the brink, the chiefs of state, who would be ultimately responsible for their country's fate, attempted to back away. But the pull of military schedules dragged them forward. Can't understand the war in political terms. So we understood in terms of the pull of military schedules. All right. Again, what do we make of this argument? There was a system of interlocking military schedules, mobilization schedules. It's followed from the logic of the Schlieffen Plan. Once Russia ordered general mobilization, Germany couldn't wait. Germany couldn't allow the Russian mobilization to run its course. If so, if they did that, they would have to divide their forces and defend their east, and they couldn't implement the Schlieffen Plan with any possibility of success. They had to capitalize on this brief time window that they had while Russia was still mobilizing. Russia mobilized a lot more slowly than Germany. So as soon as Russia mobilized, Germany would have to mobilize and indeed attack France. Because she needed the decision of, in the West to be made before she had to defend against Russia in the East. Right? So Russian mobilization would lead to a German mobilization and would therefore lead to war. These plans were interlocked. Now the fact that a system of interlocking mobilization plans existed, it's true, does that mean it was a cause of the war? Well, no. Because the question is, what triggers it? What sets it off? There has to be something that sets it off. If everyone understands the system and the political leadership is are free agents, they make the decision to set it off, knowing full well what the consequences would be, well, then that's effectively a decision to start the war. Right? If Russia knows that when she orders general mobilization on July 30th, 1914, that's going to lead to a German mobilization and thus to a war, then a decision on the part of Russia to order that general mobilization was a decision to start the war. And if they, you know, maybe they made it because they were under so much pressure from the generals, they made it for military reasons because they thought that Germany was about to get in the first blow, well, you know, then you might be able to say that the system was the cause of the war. Or if they didn't understand what they were doing, if they didn't realize that their mobilization would lead to a German mobilization and thus to the war, you say, well, you know, then you could blame the system. But if everyone understood it and the decision to start with this whole thing was made for political reasons, not in order to preempt what the Germans were doing, then you can't blame the mobilization system for the start of the war. So that's what we have to look at, right? If the decision to order the first mobilization was made in full knowledge of what the consequences would be, and if the people who made that decision were not under pressure from the generals to do this for essentially military reasons, but it was done for political reasons, then you couldn't say that this stuff is a cause of the war. So therefore, for it to be a cause of the war, one or the other of those two things had to be true. Maybe number one, they didn't understand what they were doing. Number two, they were under such pressure from the generals that they had to take this decision, for essentially military reasons. Right? So armed with that whole analysis, we can then look at the documents. And in particular, there's one thing that we need to focus on, which are the documents bearing on that key Russian decision, the decision of July 30th, 1914, to order a general mobilization. Did they not understand what the consequences were? It turns out they did understand what the consequences were. The evidence is quite clear that they understood what this meant. Did they do it because they were under such pressure from the generals that they were afraid that Germany would preempt? No, they did not do it for that reason. They did it because they thought the war was inevitable for political reasons, given the political stance that the Central Powers had taken. And it's quite extraordinary. Did the Germans have a policy of going first? Was this a case of the logic of preemption? No, the Germans had a policy of going second, waiting for the Russians to go first. Why did they adopt that policy? For domestic political reasons, largely, because they wanted their own people to feel that they were fighting a defensive war. So they deliberately waited for Russia to go first. This is not a case of the reciprocal fear of surprise attack. Now, all these things are important because we've unpacked the general argument that the coming of war in 1914 is to be understood in terms of the nature of the military system that was in place at the time. We've looked at all the arguments that support that conclusion. None of them are really hold up in the light of the analysis, neither in terms of their logic nor in terms of the evidence supporting it, implying that, more generally, if this theory about inadvertent war or accidental war doesn't hold in the case of July 1914, which is the main case used to support it, then you really got to wonder about whether it's of any value whatsoever in terms of the light it sheds on the whole question of why do we have war? How can we make for a stable international system? So this stuff is quite important. All right, I'm going to stop there. Next time I can actually look at the war itself.